Hi there, this is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. This morning's guest is Rachel Feldman, who is on the phone with me. And we're going to be talking about her recent trip to Israel and bearing witness in Israel, and also about her experiences here in Vermont. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Pat.
Yeah, this is great. Sorry you couldn't make it into the studio, but we will have a good show, I am sure. So first, I know you were on Kevin's Ellis's show back in January, but you didn't talk much about who you are here in Vermont, and I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your background.
All right, well, thank you. Yes, I was on the show with Kevin back in January after I returned
right.
from my first trip back to Israel. But here in Vermont, well, I have worked in media and in state government for almost 20 years. I began at WCAX and really enjoyed producing, reporting, and anchoring there. And then I went to Israel for a year to teach English in the city of Ramle Lod, which is an integrated city about 25 minutes southeast of Tel Aviv. When I came back, I worked at the Vermont Arts Council, and then I became chief of staff to then-Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. And that was an amazing experience, right up through the governor's office. And then I spent some time working at Vermont State Employees Credit Union, VSECU, as a communications specialist, and then came back to the state right at the beginning of COVID. I started in March of 2020. Working as the public information officer for the Department of Corrections. And most recently, I served as the chief of communications and legislative affairs for the Agency of Human Services.
And I think it was, I met you first when you were working for, at the time, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. I think that's when you and I hooked up.
Yes, that was 2013 when that began, and that was an incredible ride and really taught me a lot about the importance of collaboration, of listening and learning, and always having space for views with which you may not agree, but that you have to hold space for, and it can help you really hone your own beliefs to know how other people think, and it teaches you respect as well for people with whom you disagree. I learned that a lot from the governor.
That's a great lesson to learn given what's going on these days, Rachel. So I invited you on the show because I was following you on Facebook and your more recent trip to Israel. And what you, I just wanted to talk about what you experienced there. Can you talk about why you went, what you experienced, and what you'd like to tell folks about Israel?
Absolutely. Well, first, I want to say that everybody should visit Israel. It is a place that people really should see for themselves and experience for themselves, and just putting in a plug for the food, taste for themselves.
Exactly.
It is a unique country in the Middle East. And so, as I mentioned, I did teach there from 2011 to 2012. I went there not speaking, reading, or understanding a word of Hebrew. And then when October 7th happened, one of my students that I taught that year was murdered at the Nova Music Party. His name is Roni Polvanov. He was 23 years old. He was a firefighter. And on October 7th, the world changed, I would say, for everyone who is Jewish and for many people around the world. And so at that point, I took leave from my job because as a spokesperson, I couldn't use my own personal voice. My voice belongs to the state. So in order for there to be objectivity and fairness for those that I represented with the state, I took leave and was able to get back to Israel in January. I wanted to go and bear witness. I wanted to see with my own eyes what happened on October 7th. And I went to some of the towns where Hamas terrorists attacked and murdered and took hostages. I went to some of the kibbutzes, and I also went to the site of the Nova Music Festival where Roni was murdered. And when I returned to America, I felt different. I knew that I had to be back in Israel. I knew that there was something much bigger happening globally with us as humanity. And I have no choice, I feel, but to be part of trying to do what we Jews call tikkun olam, repair and heal the world. And so I resigned from my job and I went back to Israel, and I've been living there for about 2 months. I lived for a brief period in Jerusalem, And then I moved to the city of Yafo, which is just south of Tel Aviv. It's a predominantly Arab neighborhood. And I lived there the entire time. I loved it. And it was through Ramadan. And once again, back to the food. Oh, food in Yafo during Ramadan. I can't even. So
that's great.
While I was there, I spent a lot of time, again, talking to people, listening and learning. Because as an American, I don't know. And the only way that I can even begin to gain an understanding is by listening to people of all backgrounds in Israel. So
now, you told me that in Israel, I think we're all thinking Jewish in Israel, but there are a lot of people from with other backgrounds in Israel. It is not just Jewish people in Israel, correct? They're just – it's sort of a melting pot.
That is correct. The population of Israel is 9 million people. It's a very small country. It's about the size of New Jersey. It's only a little bit larger in terms of landmass than Vermont. And there are 7 million Jews. There are 2 million Arabs. And there are also Christians, Hindu, agnostic. And people do live together with equal rights. And no country is perfect. But Israel is, inside of its borders, a peaceful country. There are terror attacks. There are terror attacks on basically a weekly basis in Israel. But the community of Israel itself, those 9 million people, live in Israel with full and equal rights and in peace. And I guess the best way to explain this is on my street in Yafo, there was a Chabad, a synagogue, right around the corner. There was a mosque two doors down from me, and then up the street was the Christian school founded by Scottish immigrants in the 1800s.
Wow.
So
they all live in peace.
Israel.
So you showed me something pretty disturbing. You have an app, which you were given while you were there, an app that shows where the bombs are going, and I just was blown away. I just was, let me rephrase that. I just was shocked with seeing what you look at every day and experience every day there. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So Israelis all have an app on their phone. There are a few different ones I have so far. There's another Red Alert. And what it does is it alerts you whenever there is something detected by the Iron Dome, if you are in the region where that interception is going to take place, there are sirens that sound, and you have about 60 seconds to get to a bomb shelter. There are public bomb shelters throughout the country. They are clearly labeled on Google Maps. In addition, a lot of homes have mamads, safe rooms. So you have about 60 seconds to get to that safe room. And the Iron Dome, more often than not, is able to intercept those rockets. But this happens every single day. There was not a day that I was in Israel where the Red Alert app was not going off. If the towns that it was showing were in the north, that was Hezbollah firing. If it was something near the Gaza envelope, that was Hamas firing. And it's even down to a time schedule. Hamas fires directly on the hours, so that's how you know it's them. Hezbollah likes to go at random times to keep people on their toes. And then at 7 o'clock at night, that hour is reserved for Islamic Jihad. So you even know who's firing based on what time of day.
I'm sorry. That is bizarre. I would think if you were attacking somebody that you would want, like October 7th, which was just horrendous, that you would want to use the element of surprise, but, it's a strange way to make a point. I just find it interesting.
October 7th was also a ground invasion. Rockets, yes, they're fired at innocent civilians with the intent of killing innocent Israeli civilians.
Right.
But the Iron Dome it's miraculous.
Yep.
And what we saw when Iran, for the first time in history, fired directly on Israel with more than 300 suicide drones and ballistic missiles 2 weeks ago, 99% of those were intercepted. And that was a result of the Iron Dome, the Israeli Air Force,
right,
and multiple allied air forces coming together. And some of the pilots who have spoken since have said that it was like Star Wars.
Wow.
But the defense system is built because Israel is committed to defending and protecting its innocent civilians. That's why Israel's army is the Israeli Defense Forces. Israel is committed to the protection of the people who live in Eretz Israel, thus the public bomb shelters everywhere, thus the red alert, so that everybody knows to get to safety immediately.
It's really miraculous when you think about it. If you're talking about the site, like New Jersey, where I lived, that's pretty tiny, and to be up against different countries that are set on your annihilation, that's quite an amazing feat. And I think it's their determination and belief in who they are. Correct?
Yeah. Israel lives in a very dangerous neighborhood and is surrounded by countries that have openly stated that they want Israel to not exist, and governmental entities in those countries
right.
who have stated they do not want Israel to exist. When I was there in 2011, we went all over the country, and one of it's funny but also very telling moments was standing on one of the southernmost parts, and our tour guide said, "Now look to the right. You see them? They want to kill us. Look to the south. That's another country. They want to kill us too. And then look over to the west. Yep, them too." And they're like, "So don't worry. We have fields that are full of landmines. Don't walk in them. They're there just in case. We're not expecting anything bad to happen, but just in case."
Huh.
And it is hard to describe how small Israel is and how close
right.
all of these countries are. Living in America, we have so much space, and even things that happen within our nation can still happen very far away. Like something happens in Minnesota, that's far away from us here in Vermont. In Israel, I feel like people from Vermont would go to Israel and be like, "Oh, I get this. Yeah,
right.
This is how we are. It's one big small town."
It's weird that everybody's so close. I remember I used to travel to Switzerland for my job, one night I visited a friend and we walked across his field and we were in France. And then another time I wound up Germany, and it was just so easy to step over a line and there you were in another country. And that shows you how close everybody is in the Middle East. That's pretty scary. Can you talk a little bit, and you were talking about the way the relationship is happening here with people chanting from the river to the sea, and the expressions of hostility and pretty much hatred, correct?
Yeah. Thank you for asking about that phrase. So the original phrase in Arabic is "from the water to the water, Palestine is Arab." What that means is that from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, they're saying that Palestine, that land, will not have Israel and will not have Jews. It doesn't mean a peaceful one state where everybody coexists. Hamas has stated in their charter that they intend to destroy Israel and Jews the world entire. That is in their charter. So that phrase itself is calling for the destruction of Israel and the death of Jews. When translated into English, "from the river to the sea," it doesn't sound
right
as violent as it is in Arabic, but it still holds the same meaning.
Yep.
And I truly do believe that the majority of people who are protesting in support of Palestine here in America are well-meaning, peaceful people who truly do believe that they are pushing for a peaceful coexistence. But that is not the message that is being heard loud and clear by the Jewish
right.
community, in, not just in America, but in many Western nations.
Right. Rachel, we were just talking about the real meaning of from the river to the sea. I just skip a little bit to the, I wanted to talk about this later anyway, about the protest. Do you think that the people that are chanting this truly understand what they're saying from that phrase?
I don't believe that the majority of people do know what it means. I know that when there was a big rally outside of the State House here in Vermont in December,
right,
the rally began by chanting it in Arabic. And I don't speak much Arabic, and the only words I know are swear words, and I wouldn't speak them on the radio.
You and me both.
But I can understand certain things, and I understood this phrase, and it was the from the water to the water in Arabic, but wow. In addition, it did include a call to remove the Jews in Arabic. And then they said, and now we will say it in English the way that you know it. And then it was a phrase that, again, when you hear it, it sounds bucolic. It really would resonate here in Vermont, like from the river to the sea. We're very nature-based. And
right.
What's arguable about freedom? Freedom is certainly something that we as Vermonters, as Americans, it is the bedrock of who we are. And I really do not believe the majority of people know how harmful they are being. But what has been very harmful is that when the Jewish community has said, this is a call for our genocide, this phrase makes us feel unsafe and threatened, unlike other marginalized and oppressed groups, we have not been listened to. We have been gaslit and debated and told why we're wrong for feeling this way. I would like to think that if I used a phrase that somebody then told me made them feel unsafe and threatened, that I would immediately stop using it, apologize, and say, I will find another way to express the sentiment that I'm feeling.
Right.
I can't understand why Jews in particular are being challenged and gaslit when we are pointing out very real events of anti-Semitism and very real calls for our genocide, because we know the original phrase and we know the intent of the original phrase, and we saw what that original phrase means in action on October 7th, and Hamas filmed it hoping to show the entire world as
right.
well. This is what we mean to do.
You mentioned genocide, Rachel, and you and I talked about that, about where that word came from, and that you tied it into the Holocaust. And can you talk about the constant, the use of the phrase genocide all the time, which just isn't happening?
So to begin with the origin of the phrase genocide, the term genocide. The term genocide was created specifically to describe the Holocaust, because what the Nazis perpetrated against the Jews in the Holocaust it was beyond current language's ability to describe. And so that became genocide. And genocide has a very specific definition. And it also has very specific tells. Genocide is the deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or ethnic group. And it can be designated as well and seen as well mathematically. So a genocide results in the mass decrease in the population of a group because of systematic murder and destruction.
And that'll sort of lead into the discussion of the Holocaust. But Rachel, we have a caller. Michelle from Plainfield is calling in. And Michelle, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Rachel?
Yes. Well, first, I just want to thank you, Pat, for having Rachel on. I really appreciate it. I hope Rachel goes on every radio station in Vermont. And I also wanted to say, I wanted to sort of, in a way, answer a question. I think that somewhere in the academic world, I know this from a friend of mine who's an academic. He says Israel was a historical mistake, he thinks.
Huh.
And I think it's somehow coming down from a, what I would say is a kind of distorted view of what colonialism, that the Jews are colonists, and it was a historical mistake, and it goes on from there. And I think there's they think of themselves as leftists. I don't, but I think there's a kind of left-wing analysis that goes like that. And I'd be interested if Rachel has heard about it. I know it exists, and it's very, very disturbing.
Thank you.
And including Jewish academics, too, by the way. Okay, I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Yes, thank you, Michelle. That's an excellent question, and there's a lot to unpack here, so I will try to do this as concisely as possible. Israel is actually the greatest decolonization movement in history. Jews are an ethno-religious group, and our ethnicity can be traced back to what is now the land of Israel, what has always been known as Israel, but the Levant. And all of our blood ties back there. So in reality, Israel is Jews returning to their native homeland, our native homeland. However, and I have read a number of books that have been published over the past 20 to 25 years, because the last 20 to 25 years, there has been a massive shift in public perception of what Israel is. Israel has started to be painted as the white colonialist oppressor as a state. I can tell you, for one thing, the idea that Israel is white is absolutely false. Second of all, the charge of an apartheid state has been levied against Israel. That, again, is just patently false. That Israel somehow doesn't have a right to exist, or that, as Michelle said, that her friend had said, was an historical mistake. After World War II, Israel, then known as Palestine, was the only place that Jews could go. That was the British Mandate of Palestine. First of all, Jews have been living on that land for thousands and thousands of years. But in addition, there were hundreds of thousands of refugees who were liberated from the concentration camps, who were refused entry anywhere else in the world, including in America. So it is the Jewish homeland. But many of those refugees had nowhere else to go. They couldn't return to their homes. Their homes had been given to other families, and they had no right to claim them back. Their possessions, their property had all been taken. And the world was anti-Semitic. The world, as I said, was refusing entry to Jewish refugees after the Holocaust. And the British Mandate of Palestine was the only place, really, that would take in Jews. And that's our home. So in terms of Israel being an historical mistake, Israel has always existed. But with this change in the narrative, especially in what's being taught in academia about Israel, these things that are simply patently not true, but that's framing Israel as somehow an oppressor, it has created enough of a sentiment here in the West that, especially if people have not been to Israel and been to other countries in the Middle East to see how they're different, it's very easy to get an idea of a place that, quite frankly, yeah, Israel looks in a lot of ways like America. You can navigate Israel much the same way you can navigate America, but the West does not translate to the Middle East. The Middle East is unique. It is a unique place, and that's why I do, again, encourage everybody to go and see for themselves. And I wholly reject the idea that Israel is an historical mistake. I think Israel is a necessity, and I think that what we are seeing happening right now in America is an indication of why. Because I will speak for myself personally. I'm Jewish. I live in America. And I do not trust that I will actually be safe.
Right.
A week from now, a month from now, but in Israel, even with all those rocket attacks, even with the specter of October 7th only 202 days away or ago, I feel safer there than I do anywhere else on the face of this planet.
You know, you said that on Kevin's show, and I wrote it down because I thought, whoa, that is a statement. Of course, what's going on now in this country, I can understand there's the war between Israel and Hamas and Iran. We have protests here in the U.S., and I just – there was a professor from Columbia, which is the latest place where they have the protests, that he was locked out of going onto the campus in on the Columbia campus, and they said that because they couldn't keep him safe, and he was adamant that this is as much about Jewish people as doing something to America, the downfall of America. And I was fascinated listening to him, a Jewish professor at Columbia, not allowed to teach, not allowed to go on campus. I mean, what is going on?
Yeah, that's Professor Shai Davidi at Columbia. He has been very vocal since October about what he's been seeing on campus. He's very vocal on Twitter. If anybody's interested, he urges everybody to go and look at what he's been posting, and he works with a lot of Jewish students. But yes, the other day his ID card was deactivated.
Right.
Because there's the encampment on campus, and the reason given was that they could not guarantee his safety. But that's not a singular incident. In London, a man was told that he could not cross the street. He was on his way back from synagogue on Saturday, and there are massive anti-Israel marches throughout London every Saturday. And the police officer told him that he could not cross the street because he was openly Jewish.
Huh.
I myself have noticed that certain people's faces change when they see my Star of David necklace or my hostage dog tag necklace with the Hebrew writing on it. It's a subtle thing, but I see it. And I'm not alone in seeing that shift, that change. It's a level of hatred that my grandparents described to me, that my parents described to me, that I have never experienced on this level ever before in my life. And one of the hardest parts of it is the gaslighting that many members of the Jewish community get when we say we're experiencing this anti-Semitism. We're told why it's not anti-Semitism.
Wow, Rachel.
Instead of people listening to our lived experiences.
It's upsetting to hear you talking about this. I always, but it's Vermont. We do have a caller, Rachel, Robert from Marshfield. Robert, you're on the air with Rachel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the United States and Israel. These people that are against Israel, and I'll tell you that it's going to come sooner than later, are going to wish that they had Israel on our side. Because I think Israel is one of the best. But I think they would be quicker to jump in to help us.
Yep.
Faster than any other country.
Well,
thank you very much.
First of all, it's the only democracy over in the Middle East, and we have been allies for I think 75 years, right, Rachel?
Correct.
Yeah, so I'd like to shift just a little bit and maybe talk about Palestine itself, because I know that our legislature submitted a letter, to President Biden. There were 67 lawmakers that signed on to a letter urging President Biden to demand permanent ceasefire in Gaza. And I know at church we pray for the Palestinian people as we do for the people in Israel. My impression is that they're sort of being held captive. They're not necessarily allowed to leave Gaza. It's hard to get food and supplies in. What's happening in Palestine itself?
So Gaza, first of all, I would love to address the aid. The aid story that is coming out of Gaza is not entirely accurate. There is a bigger picture to this. For example, and this is information from the UN, from UNRWA, and from COGAT, groups all that are involved in bringing aid over. So this is via the COGAT website. For April 17th of this year, 325 trucks were inspected by Israel. 296 were received by the UN agencies across the border, so in Gaza, but only 153 had been distributed. So this ties to a bigger distribution issue. Israel has been sending in aid, and more aid. There is no backlog of aid on Israel's side. The backlog is in the distribution in Gaza, and it is not a military job. It is not the job of the IDF to distribute aid. It's actually a great security concern. So it is the UN agencies that are responsible and the aid workers that are responsible for delivering that aid. There is a giant backlog. The other problem with aid is that it is being co-opted by Hamas. It is being sold to people at greatly inflated prices. There is some food insecurity in parts of Gaza. That is not a result of aid not getting in. That is a result of aid being deliberately kept from people and being taken for Hamas. So, but in addition to that, I talked to many, many, many people in Israel, including many soldiers who had returned from Gaza. And I want to impress upon people as much as possible that I did not hear anybody celebrating the death of any innocent Palestinians. And where I did see celebration of death was in the videos of October 7th. And I've watched the 47-minute video, the joy, the glee in murdering people in cold blood in their beds. That was celebration of death. There is not celebration of the death of Palestinians.
Right.
But Israelis are very united in the objectives of this war, which Israel did not start. And that is to bring the 133 hostages that are still in Gaza back home and to eliminate Hamas. Hamas could end this war right now if they released the hostages
right.
and they surrendered. And that would be for the good of Israelis and Palestinians. Palestinians in Gaza have been manipulated and used by Hamas in horrible ways. They have not had freedom under their own elected government. And if we truly want peace in that region, Hamas cannot be part of that equation. But Hamas continues to reject ceasefire after ceasefire after ceasefire. So back to the letter that more than a third of the legislature signed. Again, I've worked with many of the people who signed the letter, and I know them to be good people who want good for others. And on its face, it looks like a call for peace, but we're only asking Israel to cease fire. And since Hamas has stated that they will repeat October 7th again and again and again and again, the message that that letter sends to the Jewish community in Vermont, because let's face it, it's not reaching Israel. Israel doesn't even
right.
really know where Vermont is. But the message it sends is that we want Jews to just quietly die. We don't want Israel to defend itself because Hamas is not going to cease fire.
Rachel, let us talk about the Holocaust, because there are clearly Holocaust deniers. And I think you were right that if we actually spent time understanding what the Holocaust is about, and I told you when I lived in Brooklyn, 188 Parkside Avenue, I remember, between Ocean and Flatbush. And my mother-in-law was Jewish, and she taught me how to run a kosher home. And but her whole family was wiped out in the Holocaust. So every time I hear Holocaust deniers, I just cringe. I'm like, God, do your research. So talk about why you think it's important for people to understand about the Holocaust.
Thank you. So the Holocaust. Studying the Holocaust, which it did not just happen with one day there were death camps. It was more than a decade from the beginning to the ultimate 6 million Jews murdered that people, some of them, know these days. And so to learn that is to learn really about the darkest part and capacity of humanity. And in learning that, that is how we can make good on the promise of never again. And there have been some startling statistics that have come out in the past 6 months. For example, in December, a poll from The Economist shows that 1 in 5 Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 believe the Holocaust is a myth. And that speaks to a lack of Holocaust education in schools. Currently, Vermont is the only state in New England that doesn't have Holocaust education standards for our students. And I believe that there is a direct correlation between that and the second highest per capita in the nation increase in anti-Semitic hate crimes that Vermont saw in 2023. Because anti-Semitism, which is what was at the root of the Holocaust, is a very unique form of prejudice and hate. And it is where the Jew and the Jewish people become the placeholder for whatever a society hates the most about themselves. And so it's constantly shape-shifting. But in 1930s Germans were the butt of the world because they were responsible for World War I. And they turned on the Jews of Germany, the most assimilated Jews in all of Western Europe, saying that it was actually their fault, that World War I was their fault. And so now, here in America, what we're seeing is that Jews are the white colonialist apartheid oppressors. But that is absolutely not the case. It simply doesn't hold water. None of those charges are true. And we need to be teaching our children what it looks like when we start going down the path towards the ultimate destruction of our entire society, because what starts with the Jews never ends with the Jews. Vermont students need to learn that the Holocaust began with boycotts, with propaganda, with short, catchy, insistent, rhyming slogans, things that all sound a little familiar to things that are going on today.
Right.
And to take just one little note from the current conflict, there is one book that has been found all over Gaza, translated into Arabic. It's been found in UNRWA schools. It's been found in private homes. It's been found in offices. That book is Mein Kampf.
Huh. Well, we know that name.
Yes, we do. So if we study the Holocaust, which is the most well-documented genocide, it will teach us what the signs are that we as a society are starting to go down a dangerous road. It will also teach why so much of the response we're seeing to the Israel-Hamas war is coming out as anti-Semitism, because we are not teaching our children what anti-Semitism is. And so they are not realizing that they are falling into the same trap. The Holocaust inversion that's being used against the Jewish community, accusing Jews of genocide. I'm called a Nazi on a daily basis on social media platforms, daily. It is a very specific weaponization that is anti-Semitic. Huh. And we need to teach our children to be better, to not be like them.
Rachel, we've got another caller, Mary from Randolph Center. Mary, you're on the air with Rachel. Do you have a question?
Well, just a comment.
Okay.
Good morning, Rachel. I'm so moved by this, all this conversation. It makes me very sad. But we had an experience this summer with two of my grandchildren. We took them to Washington, D.C., and we went to the Holocaust Museum. Mm. And it was a life-changing experience, certainly for us all. I mean, we've talked about it. The kids have read books, and, you know, they knew what they were going to see, but we didn't know what we were going to see either. And it was an experience that I wish every person could see and feel. And it was a very somber, sad terrifying experience, but so worthwhile. And yeah, just a wonderful experience.
Mary, thank you. And thank you for educating your children in that way, because that's very important, as Rachel is talking about how we have to educate our kids about what's going on and how to understand.
Yeah, thank you, Mary.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, and thank you for bearing witness and for visiting. I grew up outside of D.C. and actually most recently went to the Holocaust Museum with a friend who served in the legislature in December. And it's an incredible experience, and I join you in urging everybody to go to the museum. And it's heavy, but it is so important, and it is beautifully done.
That's great.
So, Mary, thank you.
I have never been there, and I think that's got to be on my bucket list, because I bet, as Mary said, it's very powerful to witness. I love that phrase, bear witness. I don't know why it's so powerful that you're bearing witness. So, Rachel, we only have a couple of minutes left. Is there anything that maybe you'd like to close out the show with that you feel you'd like to tell people about? 2 minutes we have.
All right. Well, thank you, Pat, for having me on, and thank you to everyone who's listening. And I think what I want to say to everybody is that it's very clear that this conflict in the Middle East is bringing up a lot of charged emotions for all of us here at home. But if we can remember that above all, we should be kind to each other, we should really listen to each other, and we shouldn't be screaming at each other. If we can remember that, then I don't think that this very charged, very emotional issue is going to rip us apart. What I have seen, unfortunately, over the past 6 months has been a rise in hate, has been a growingly increasingly unsafe environment here in Vermont, across the country, and in a lot of different countries around the world. We can do better than this. We're Vermonters. We make great neighbors. We want diversity. We want to include people. Please let us listen to each other, and please listen to your Jewish neighbors. Check in on your Jewish neighbors and your Jewish friends. If you haven't talked to them in a while, it's okay. Reach out and say, I don't know what to say, but I feel like I should be calling and asking, how are you?
So, Rachel,
I just thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You're my dear friend, and I really appreciate your speaking out, and I hope I know you will do the same going forward. As one of our callers said, get on more radio stations and spread the word. Anyway, Rachel Feldman, thank you very much. And thank you all for listening. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.